From an undisclosed location in the Nevada desert, this is Jennifer Morency of WTF Radio. Welcome to Open Mic Night at the Cormorant Cafe, with your Master of Ceremonies and Master of Debates, Rob. My teddy bears were stolen by a...
Oh, all right. So Jill is over there slapping the peanut butter and jam onto the sandwiches, cutting them into quarters, and also making you guys coffee. And Morency is probably recording more clips for this very event. She's way ahead. She's like 2 or 3 weeks ahead. So I'm actually going to steal from the future and put her stuff in this episode. This is, oh wow. So yeah, this is episode 10. Anyway, I'm gonna go. Sexually harass the barista. You guys can, I don't know, cancel me or something. Anyway, I'll be back in a few minutes when it's actually 7:15. Hello. I'm back. All right, so it is 7:15. This is the Cormorant Cafe. I'm R. Wesley Edwards, aka the actual cormorant. You guys should really look that bird up. He's cool. There's video. Look at YouTube. Look at the find cormorant swimming video. Actually, if you're on YouTube, you probably don't have to use the word video in the search. All right, where was I? Okay, so this is a Cormorant Cafe, and this is open mic night because it's Wednesday at whatever time it really is, 7:15. And so welcome. There's a couple clips from Jennifer Morency. There's me doing my dweebcast shtick. And I don't know, maybe I'll read the next part of Macmillan. I don't really get any feedback because I guess there's no actual audience members. Although I had someone message me and ask me, this is going to embarrass that person, so I'm going to put all their contact information in the show notes. So this guy John, I know, he messaged me on Telegram asking if I was actually recording in a coffee shop. And I don't know if he was trolling me, but oh my God, come on. All right, so let me see. All right, so let's see. This is a Cormorant Cafe. I am who I am. We have stuff. I don't know if I even wrote anything. It's 7:15, open mic. Something about the barista. All right, I think I did my job. If you guys need anything, you should come up here and read, and then I'll take requests. Okay, well, I'm going to warm us up, I think, with something I wrote called A Song About Loss. It's real short. It's one page. There should be a stack of these one-page kind of like scenes, sort of like how a painting is just a scene, but with just words. I can't find them. I was looking earlier. And I found a folder that was actually called Scenes, and it had the likes of Jennifer P. Henn and this thing I'm about to read. So, I don't know. I'll keep looking. We have, like I said, we have a couple things from the other, from, Morency today. And, I'll probably read that section of the book again that I read a couple of weeks ago. But, because I read the first few chapters last week, the very next section, you know, like the continuation, if we were checking in on my character. All right, so here we are. I think it's called A Song About Loss. Okay, this is A Song About Loss by R. Wesley Edwards. That's me, obviously. The birds were everywhere, in the trees, on the ground, everywhere. They were all about the same, small and gray, mottled or pied with spots on the head and neck, darker gray in wings and tails, with a lighter gray breast, the same again under their wings. Her words still sung, as did my cheek. The words I deserved, probably, the slap less so. I was hurt, so not yet angry, but aware enough to realize I'd be angry later. Perhaps that was comforting in its way. I concentrated on what I was doing, and here and now, walking to my car, avoiding small birds. I slapped my thigh, feeling the hard and sharp of my keys. I pressed my fingers into the pocket, and they jingled as I pulled them free. I was at the car. I let out a breath and kind of sobbed. The fall morning was blurry with fog and my own tears. I remember struggling with the key and the locking slit on the door, poking tentatively until getting lucky. It clicked in, like always. I was inside the car. I heard a muted tap-tap-tap sound and sniffled teardrops on my jacket. I realized I'd been crying. Out the windshield, I could see the small birds, the trees, devoid of leaves for fall and winter. Her bungalow, the door, especially the door. My keys were in my lap. I tried to concentrate on the here and now, what I was doing, what needed to be done. I sniffled, wiped my face twice, both sides, and picked up the keys. Jerking my face to the side, I blinked away the blur, screwing my eyes tightly shut. I put the key in the ignition and started the car. I was already wearing my seatbelt. I didn't remember putting it on. I never did, I realized. Softly, music began playing from the middle of a song. A solo female vocalist. Country, it doesn't matter which. I turned it up and shifted into reverse. Gravel beneath my tires made a satisfying crunch, and birds hopped and flew in all directions like smoke or dust. I could feel my breathing catch. I shifted back to park. I sat and cried in a cloud of mockingbirds as a fiddle accompanied the soft voice singing a final verse about loss. Alright, so that was called A Song About Loss. It was supposed to be an example of one of those scenes, but I guess something kind of does happen in it. Alright, let me see. We have a sponsored segment, assuming we still have a sponsor. So that's what you might hear right after this. And I think I'm gonna have Jennifer just pop in directly after the sponsor, because honestly, you guys would rather look at her than me.
Welcome to this week's episode of WTF, the show that tries to answer its own question. By the time you hear this broadcast, the Mountain West states will have gone through a huge winter storm. I did some extra shopping and took out all of the household trash because I knew things would be wet and slippery here for several days, and not in a good way, unless you count P-Hub. I'm not getting paid to say this, but I have to give a shout out to my favorite instant coffee. It's a store brand called One of the Perks, and it only costs $3 for an 8-ounce jar. Cheap and strong, kind of like me, it's the fuel that keeps me going. I love coffee as much as senile politicians like sniffing children. I think the best restaurant brand out there is McDonald's. A lot of people, especially brunch liberals, would say the best coffee is from Starbucks. Those are the same people who tend to buy an iPhone because they like the logo. But we'll talk about that another time. So until I got a gift card earlier this year, the only time I've ever been inside of a Starbucks was when it was closed. It was the record hot summer of 17, and my air conditioner had conked out. The nearest place that had air conditioning was an all-night supermarket, which happened to have a Starbucks in the store. The Starbucks part was actually closed, but it was the only place that had chairs. So I bought a bottle of Gatorade for $1 and drank it in the Starbucks. My other Starbucks story is also weird but true. I was undergoing physical therapy at a large medical center, and I used to bring my own iced coffee in plastic bottles from home. Somebody had donated a bunch of Starbucks cups to the cafeteria there, which didn't even sell Starbucks. So I poured my cheap iced coffee from the bottle into one of the Starbucks cups, and I sat there drinking it, feeling like $1 million. That's the closest I've ever come to feeling privileged. A lot of liberals on Twitter are attacking people like me who couldn't afford to graduate from a university and who only have a GED or an associate degree. The truth is, if only lawyers can make laws, then laws will mostly benefit lawyers. But the brunch liberals will keep on brunching, as nothing fundamentally changes. They're privileged enough not to know or care. I'm broke, so I can't afford to stick my head in the sand for another 4 years. Thank you all for being such a great audience. If you want to help buy me a sensible meal or some iced coffee, my donation link is v.gd/jenmor. My Twitter is at Jennifer Morency with an I.
Okay, I'm feeling a little personally attacked there, Jennifer. Yeah, the joke's on you. I go to Starbucks because I like the Starbucks logo, especially the old one with the nipples. Also, I don't have an iPhone. I really do have a lot of brunch, though, but I think that's really because I wake up late and because breakfast is overpriced or because I want coffee with my burger. Maybe I'm overthinking this. All right, so that was one of our WTF, I say hour, I'm totally taking possession. So thanks again, Jennifer, for the little humor clips you bring us. Almost certainly the reason people tune in. I don't know if I care, since the only reason this thing exists is to convince me that I should still be writing things. All right, so you guys, you want to come up now? No? You should come up. Someone should come up and read. It can't just be Jennifer, and it can't just be me.
From a parallel universe, this is Jennifer Morency with a science episode of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, the World Telecommunications Forum broadcast. I don't know anything about this other, supposedly thieving Jennifer. The only thing I stole from the cafe was Robert's heart. Also, this segment contains adult humor, which means very juvenile humor, so it may not be suitable for some listeners. To begin on a serious note, when I first moved into the motel, my health was very bad. I used to make my iced coffee for the next morning the night before, and put it in the refrigerator. At the time, I thought that it was highly optimistic of me to expect that I would live another day. Sometimes optimism can be funny, though. Like before the pandemic, I met a guy who was shopping at the dollar store. I saw that he had a 12-pack of toilet paper and a bottle of Metamucil. I thought to myself, he's really optimistic. How do you like what's been happening recently with GameStop and the stonks? The Reddit guys want their stonks to fly to the moon, and Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. I wonder what kind of pickup line I could use with him. If I were an astrophysicist, I could say, instead of Mars, I would like to explore your anus, which, by the way, puts the ass in astrophysicist. Seriously though, I hope scientists really do send a probe to your anus. It would be the funniest thing ever to report about. It would almost be as cool as getting to report that Mike Hunt was elected Aiken County Sheriff. Wouldn't it be wild if they sent a probe to your anus, and they thought that it would be covered in sticky brown stuff, but they actually found out that it was covered in baby powder? So I guess you could say that I was watching a science video on the hub the other day. Let's just say that guy had an amazing donkey. As you know, behind every man is a good woman, and in that case, a very good woman. By the way, it's really pronounced Uranus, but I don't have any good urology jokes. Thank you all for being such a great audience. Hard-hitting science journalism like this doesn't pay for itself, so if you would like to help me buy some teddy bears at the dollar store before Valentine's Day, my donation link is v.gd/jenmor. My Twitter is at Jennifer Morency with an I.
Maybe it's just funnier to me than it is to you guys. Okay, so, wow. All right, let me see. What can I do with this? So first, you stole my heart and you put it in the mini fridge in the motel with the iced coffee, and you didn't expect to live in order to take it back out. So thanks for that, I guess. It also explains a few things. Let me see, what else? This behind every good man is a good woman because she's pegging him? Okay, I think I'm officially overthinking this, especially with all the nudity. Anyway, okay, so that was also Jennifer Morency, obviously, she giving us another WTF. And that one's kind of timely. If I didn't include that today, if you had to wait till next week, people would be like, what's this stonks? What's going on? What are you even talking about, Jennifer? And they would blame me. And then I would be like, what? I can't go in the past. All right. Well, that's good. I'm glad that at least one of us is working. Oh, this podcast where I just read stuff from the distant past because I think that reading it is the work. All right. Well, once again, thank you, WTF/Morency. You know what? I'm going to put your van on the cover of this week's episode because, actually, I think it's fun. Alright, so I read from Macmillan the Magician last week, and a few weeks ago I also read like a little, I kind of cut out a piece from chapter 3. So, I didn't read all of chapter 3, I just read like the first bit. And last week I read the intro, the first and second chapter, so I'm going to read the whole third chapter. So I'm gonna do like kind of a summing up for those of you who don't want to go back and listen to last week. I think the title is something like, you know, me reading from an unpublished novel for 30 minutes, something like that. All right, so okay, so we're gonna do that. Alright, so if you were a reader of if this was published, if this was finished, edited, and published, and you were a reader, and it looked anything like it does in my preview mode on my text editor. Okay, Then, by the time you reach chapter 3, you would know that the character, the main character's name is Merlin. There were a bunch of malfunctions. He's a member of a group of pirates that are called Yemra or something. There were a bunch of malfunctions. They're just kind of stuck in the middle of space, and they just keep having malfunctions. Some decades ago, he created a machine that, you know, it basically uses some science fiction-y method of detecting atmosphere. And so he's got a machine that can maybe detect a place where he could land, maybe do repairs or whatever it is he needs to do. And so he and whatever his crew is. And so the thing goes into how they're failing and sputtering and just not even doing light speed, which I guess is bad. All right. So the machine detects atmosphere, and then he basically decides to punch it and go for it. So he tells his crew, we're gonna go for it, you know, basically do or die, because if you turn on all thrusters, as it were, you're gonna burn up all your fuel and destroy your machine, but at least you can get somewhere. Otherwise, you're basically just marooned in space until you die. So, but then the next, and then he's, you know, playing, fiddling with the machine or whatever, and the next thing he knows, there's like alerts, and his crew are basically being murdered by some guy. He watches a few of them get killed right outside the viewport door. He hides, he pushes a big button that says land. He's attacked by some kind of dog creature. Then he almost traps him in a garbage disposal situation, but the computer won't crush the guy. Then he also tries to evacuate the oxygen and set the temperature really high, but the computer keeps refusing to violate the environmental protocol because the computer isn't, you know, willing to murder people. Eventually he tries to get the computer to poison the air by putting, I think, silver nitrate into the air. And I guess the computer does do that. Meanwhile, he has another fight with the dog thing, which is now, he figures out it's a vampire because it switches into a human form, which he, of course, recognizes as one of his crewmen. And then he kind of figures out that this was kind of a, because they're pirates, so he figures out that this was a policeman that had kind of figured out a way to infiltrate the group. He must have done it decades, if not century ago. Anyway, he loses consciousness either as a result of hitting the atmosphere, maybe the silver nitrate, whatever. He loses consciousness. He wakes up, he can't breathe, he just tries to set the environmental protocol back to normal, but fails. He wakes up again, he sets the environmental protocol back to normal. He hallucinates, or not, a conversation with the computer. Then he tries to figure out where he is. He climbs, the ship is all upside down. He climbs into the viewing room. He gets the viewer to work temporarily. He has a brief little stilted conversation with the computer. He looks at out the view cameras, whatever, and he looks at, you know, the area he is. He goes back to his own cabin, collects up a bunch of stuff that he thinks he might need, puts in a backpack. Then he goes to the escape pods. He takes an escape pod, he's in the air, and while he's in the air, he figures out that the escape pod he's in is escape pod number 2. And so he says he should have looked for the body of the werewolf creature. Alright, so that is the summing up of the first couple of chapters in the introduction. Okay, now that we got the summary, now that if you haven't been listening, you should be kind of up to speed. Although, honestly, I don't know who would be listening to episode 10 of something who didn't listen to episode 9, but you should maybe go back. Maybe not, I don't know. Maybe I should just summarize the whole thing and make it really short. Alright, so each of these chapters has titles, but they also have what seems like a super title, And in this case, Chapter 3's super title is AKA San Gabriel Valley, because the actual title is the Archangel Valley. And this is part one of Life Signs and Radio Signals. And I'm just going to read it. The escape pod bumped a touch on landing and skittered as the parachute caught the wind. Across the valley floor, a kilometer or so before the wind weakened and dropped the parachute in a pile of soft and knotted debris behind the sphere of the number two pod. A moment's contemplation of biofilters, in spite of his frustrated impatience, gave his mind pause as Merlin unstrapped himself and his pack. Radio. Escape pods had radios, else what would be the point of escaping? He looked again at the console he'd been staring at for forever. He looked at the curved ceiling, the various knobby protrusions on the arms of the pilot seats. Radio, 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 he breathed. He was on his knees, bending awkwardly at the waist, looking under the main console. Where the fuck is the radio? This time aloud. And then something happened that surprised Merlin, but shouldn't have. The two-ding tone of the computer. Okay, that's me messing with the microphone, sorry. The two-ding tone of the computer. Merlin? Computer? Yes, a question. Computer, please scan for radio signals, specifically any other escape pods. Alright, sorry, I'm going to have to mess with the microphone again. Alright, so he's asking the computer a thing. Where were we? Everything's an ordeal. Alright, sorry about that. Sorry about that. Computer, yes, a question. Computer, please scan for radio signals, specifically any other escape pods. Merlin, it is good to hear your voice. A brief moment and then a strong radio signal emanates from Endeavor passenger compartment, crew quarters. However, it is foreign. Another moment and, Merlin, I do not hear my sisters. The star drive, the ship... Merlin thought about returning to the wreckage. Can we disable the radio from here? The foreign, thing? Endeavor is in power-safe mode. However, stealth mode can be configured to dampen the signal. It will be easier to switch off, though, Merlin. Merlin was hallucinating, or the computer had a kind of bitchy tone. Can you switch it off from here? Merlin, I cannot do anything from here. Endeavor is in power save mode. You said that. Endeavor's main computer... Oh, the computer's talking again. Endeavor's main computer seems to be offline. What happened to her? Merlin resisted the urge to respond as though this were a real question. Instead, he asked, Computer, if I want to communicate with you as I return to the wreckage, how can this be accomplished? An indicator began blinking red on the console and the machine said, Open the compartment and retrieve the transceiver. There's an adhesive backing. Attach it above your circular hearing cavity. It is voice actuated. You talk, I hear. Merlin did as he was told, carefully affixing the radio nearly atop his skull. I trust you can hear this? This from a voice indistinguishable from his own thoughts. Computer, yes, thank you. And as he was about to push the actuator to open the hatch, almost as an afterthought, What's the atmosphere like out there? Nitrogen mainly, then oxygen, around 20%, and barely a percent is argon. Trace amounts of carbon dioxide, water vapor. The computer continued naming trace substances. Merlin shook his head. Okay, computer, thank you, that's good. He almost opened the door then, but instead said, What's the air pressure outside? Merlin, the air pressure outside is 3.01% higher than the air pressure inside. Specifically, it is 980.5 millibars inside, 1,010 millibars outside. This poses no threat to your health. It's safe for you to exit at will. Merlin took a breath and pressed the actuator, opening the hatch. He listened for, but did not hear, a rush of air. He threw on his backpack and stepped out and onto a planetary surface for the first time in over a century and a half. For the first time in over a century and a half. He was about to say something about hiding the craft when it disintegrated before his eyes, and even the parachute was sucked into nothingness. Taking a deep breath, Merlin began the hike back to Endeavor. Computer? Two dings. Is the radio signal coming from Endeavor, a beacon of some kind, or... Merlin, the signal has frequency modulation of a fixed and predictable amount and a constant amplitude. There is a boson subspace repeating signal, which may be a beacon. The two are in lockstep. However, the FM radio signal is more highly varied. If you don't wish to be found, you should disable that device. However, Merlin, computer, listening on all subspace bands, a moment. There is either a malfunction, or else we are no longer in our home galaxy. No, we're somewhere else. The computer says, calculating, and then a moment. Then the computer talking again. The normal planetary radio bands are devoid of signal. You have landed on a primitive or even uninhabited planet. Merlin says, crash landed. Is this what happened to Endeavor's computer, Merlin? He nodded, then a moment later, affirmative, computer. Merlin hiked along the northern edge of the valley, mountains to his right. It's good to be out in the air, he thought. After a dozen minutes, he was about to ask the computer how far to the wreckage, but the computer preempted him. Merlin, Merlin counted 2 seconds. The star drive's main engine, the hopper, has been exposed to the rock here. We are currently inside a vast time-like curve. This limits sensory data to the bubble event and probably shields the inside from the outside. The bubble event appears static and stable. The atmosphere is uncontaminated at present. Merlin squinted his eyes as he decided if this was a problem or if he even understood any of it. Computer? Merlin. Does exposure of the engine to planetary rock pose a threat to us? The computer says, it limits sensory data to the bubble event and... Merlin cut the machine off. Can it kill me? Merlin, 2 seconds. Not directly. However, the area is susceptible to Chahaki events, and the likelihood of such an invasion is actually quite high, near enough to 100% to be, for practical purposes, equal to 100%. This requires the existence of advanced technology in the area of the galaxy, or an unlikely coincidence. There were 2 seconds. Other than sensory data, there are no differences inside and outside the exclusion zone. This is Merlin talking. Teleportation? Incredulity infused his voice, and Merlin rubbed the back of his neck with a blue-gray hand. Oh yeah, I missed that in the introduction part where I was summarizing. So the silver nitrate that he had the computer put in the atmosphere permanently changed the color of his skin, or at least he couldn't remove the blue-gray or the steel-blue color from his skin. Okay, so incredulity infused his voice, and Merlin rubbed the back of his neck with a blue-gray hand. Yes, Merlin? Oh, it's not a question. The computer is answering the teleportation question. Yes, Merlin. 1 second this time. In a word, teleportation. He sighed. Let's hope no one has invented the thing. The computer talking. Given the likely size of the galaxy we're currently in, I'd say that isn't likely. So, computer, what's the good news? Sarcasm, apparently. 2 dings. Merlin, the atmospheric makeup, and no doubt you've noticed, indicates vast plant and animal life. You should have no trouble surviving. So the entire valley is contaminated? Contaminated isn't an accurate portrayal of the situation, and only the north section of the basin and most of the adjoining mountain range, the edge is, frankly, difficult to detect for the same reasons as other sensory data limitations. A moment passed, and then 2 dings. Computation complete. Radio signals from foreign source probably cannot exit the exclusion zone. He exhaled a sigh of relief. Well, that's good news. You requested good news, Merlin. With that, he continued his walk in silence. He'd forgotten his sandals. The landscape here was surprisingly varied. There were grasses and succulents and even the occasional fir tree. Twice his movement was interrupted by the noises of small life forms, possibly scurrying for their life from this unknown danger in engineering coveralls. A large boulder provided slight shade in the nearly midday heat. Merlin stopped for a sip of water. He took off his pack and opened it for the rinsing glass. So also saw his other shoes. He removed his ship shoes, which are like slippers, and put on his sandals. That's better, he thought. He punctured a hole in the makeshift lid with his fangs and sucked a moist sip or two, then readjusted the bag on the glass to seal the water in. He then placed it and his other shoes into his backpack. Now that's the end of the first section. Alright, so that was chapter 3, part 1. This is part 2. It's called Anomalies and Andromedans. As Merlin adjusted the pack and was thinking of continuing his walk, he saw, or thought he saw briefly, a woodsman, a man dressed all in green with a kind of pointed cap, several dozen meters up the hill. The man had on a shoulder bag of a brown material, like leather. He appeared to be writing or drawing something on a tablet. It's true Merlin may have blinked, but the man didn't fade as one may expect of a hallucination. He disappeared, he just vanished. At a sprint, Merlin went uphill to the location, but of course, there was no one. Merlin, eyes squinted as much as his eyes would squint, looking, sniffing, and finally on his belly on the ground, using his tongue, flick, 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 tasting. Someone has been here. He could taste recently expelled pheromones, and these were of his own kind. Before getting to his feet, Merlin examined the ground. Footprints. The impacted dirt was obvious to Merlin. Okay, so there are a couple of pictures in the text. One of them is kind of implied what we would see, and it's just kind of gray. And then after it says footprints, the impacted dirt was obvious to Merlin. The next picture, it just shows kind of two ovals, the way you might think footprints might work. Sorry. Okay, anyway, he's saying, teleportation. He said it aloud in a kind of breathy whisper. Where'd you go? He spoke in his normal volume, normal tone, as though he expected an answer. Two dings. I am here, Merlin. Computer, there was a man here. Did you get a visual? Two dings. Two dings. Affirmative, Merlin. A man dressed in green, observing you, making a sketch on a tablet. A sketch? Merlin didn't know how the computer knew, but let it go. Did he dematerialize or teleport or... A loss for words in sudden excitement, then vaporize or just disappear? Insufficient data to extrapolate, Merlin. Insufficient data. He isn't transparent, if this helps. Computer, I lost again. He leaned over the footprints. Please analyze these footprints. Merlin, yes. That's the computer said that. The computer said his name and the computer said yes. Merlin took a deep breath and stretched. The computer said nothing for several minutes. Merlin flicked his tongue and could no longer sense the man at all. He lowered himself back to the ground and flicked his tongue rhythmically. He could definitely detect the pheromones down here. He opened his eyes and placed one of his hands flat about a centimeter above the ground. Merlin then pressed his fingertips against the soil and leafy debris. He grabbed a handful and let it filter through his fingers. He flicked his tongue. Ah, there. He closed his eyes, flicked his tongue, and sniffed the air near the ground. He moved along the ground, barely touching it, leaving the footprints he'd discovered completely intact. He followed the scent path left by a person. He stopped when he detected the slightly pine scent of a scrub tree. He lifted the edge of the bush and peered under the brittle, tangled branches. Lizards, three of them, averaging half a dozen centimeters from nose to base of tail. Easily twice that if one included the tail. Still and silent, disturbed in their day by what was probably to them a predator. He recognized himself and grabbed the largest one. Computer! Excitement palpable exuded from him. Computer! Merlin, a brief moment, then two soft dings. Merlin, he is as tall as you and weighs slightly more. This is all information available from analyzing the impressions. Your kind, however, do not have feet that would fit those shoes. Computer! Merlin couldn't contain himself. Shut up! A moment. Computer! He held up the creature. What is this thing? That appears to be a small quadruped Andromedian. Merlin, I do not understand. These creatures live here, on this planet. He didn't say computer that time. Just like the computer didn't make its two normal chimes. We need to sample its DNA, if possible, without harming it. That was him talking. The computer says, Merlin, how would you gather your own DNA without harming yourself? Merlin thought about the kind of person that would program the escape pod's computer to have responses. Without letting go of the lizard, he carefully removed his backpack. He knelt on the ground next to it. Using his free hand, he grabbed the roll of bags and managed to tear the next one free by twisting and tugging in sudden motions. He then carefully opened it and placed the so-called small Andromedan into it and allowed the creature to swim around for several seconds. He carefully placed the bag near the bush and pressed the bottom close to the lizard's body inside the bag. He, that is it, scurried to the opening and out of the bag and back into the bush. Merlin sealed the bag and, now with both hands, reached into his pack and removed a marker. Mysterious creature, day one, midday, found in a bush, smells like people. He wrote that on the plastic. Excuse me, sorry. It didn't occur to him that his It didn't occur to him that his biolab may not function for one of many reasons associated with a star drive crashing on a planetary surface, especially after almost a century of neglect. The excitement of discovery and recognition overwhelmed him completely. He'd even almost forgotten the green man and his footprints. And that's the end of that section. Okay, this is Macmillan the Magician, Chapter 3, Part 3, which is called Out of Phase. Merlin watched the bush where he'd found the lizards for several minutes before turning and heading back in the direction he'd originally been going. The computer's ding-ding in his head like a song he couldn't shake, but couldn't remember either. Merlin, a moment then. This is a computer talking, it says Merlin. We are out of phase with space-time. Computer? He knew what that meant. His reaction was disbelief. You and the ship and everything on it and all its pieces are out of phase with reality by a fraction of a degree. The computer continued. The bubble event can be thought of as a kind of time envelope. It paused, as though for breath. Because Endeavor was in flight mode when she intersected it, when she caused it to exist, we're all out of phase with the surrounding space-time. The engine, the hopper, wasn't powered down, and it is now embedded in the billion-year-old rock here. And then Merlin talking. Are we in any danger? Merlin wondered why the computer seemed to save the pertinent information for the question and answer time after the presentation. So this part's the computer talking. There's insufficient data to fully address the seriousness of the issue, Merlin. However, if a star drive hopper were to enter atmosphere and land and stay out of phase, the occupants would be disintegrated if they attempted to exit the ship. Also, the exterior of the vehicle itself will be heating up until it melted, and, upon hull breach, the ship and everything inside would implode. This was, of course, common knowledge. There were the usual safety skits and drills, and everyone knew. This is Merlin talking. Computer, I'm outside the ship, so clearly I did not disintegrate. How did you arrive at this conclusion? Computer, it doesn't seem supported by the evidence. Maybe Merlin's in denial. This is the computer talking. Escape pod number 2 rests upon the ground behind you. And a moment later, ding ding. Computer, a moment. If I'm out of phase and you're out of phase and everything on the ship and... If I'm out of phase and you're out of phase and everything on the ship and the ship itself is out of phase, how can I breathe the air here? After a moment's thought. So that's the end of the quote. And then after a moment's thought and then quote again. And if we phase shifted the area around the ship in the way you describe, your time bubble, how did the life forms, these small Andromedians, survive? Andromedians. Never mind. I couldn't get consensus on what they'd be called. How did these life forms, those small Andromedans, survive? Then the computer says, Merlin, and then pause, longer this time. And then the computer's talking. It is an anomaly. This is the very definition of anomaly, that we don't understand. So the computer is saying, I told you it was an anomaly. All right, so Merlin talking. Are you saying I cannot leave this area? Is that what you're saying, computer? There is insufficient data to answer that at the present time, Merlin. You could attempt an experiment and report the results, but please do not approach the edge. Do not attempt to leave the bubble event. That's the end of the quote. A moment, and as Merlin said nothing, and the computer's talking again. I won't know if you disintegrated or if your radio simply couldn't penetrate back in. So obviously the priority was to not confuse the machines. And then Merlin talking. Well, I don't want to die, so, end quote. Merlin thought for a moment, quote, I'll devise an experiment if necessary later. For now, how far to the ship? And the computer answered him, and he continued walking. That's the end of section 3, chapter 3. All right, Macmillan the Magician, chapter 3, part 4 is Humans Are People Too. As he walked, Merlin started noticing patterns that weren't entirely natural. Before he lost consciousness, two parallel tracks of thick, cleanly machined metal made their way to his attention. And then it says later, so time has passed. Merlin's head hurt, and the throbbing there and in his neck and back was his reintroduction of awareness. Next was the warmth of the sun upon his skin where it was exposed. He moaned and brought a hand to his head. Computer? Nothing happened. He opened his eyes to broad daylight, and his pain fading, went to stand up. Nearby, though, was a wooden pole with a flat, though rounded at the edges, metal object attached. A shovel, he said, possibly aloud. It was covered with blood and other biological tissue. Merlin touched his ear and found, unsurprisingly, his radio communicator was missing. He spent a few minutes looking in the surrounding area and found it. He attached it back to his head near his ear slit. Computer? Two beeps. Merlin? He rubbed the back of his neck and looked more closely at his surroundings. He bent at the waist and lifted the shovel. How long has it been since our last conversation? He sniffed the shovel. He licked the shovel tentatively. The computer's requisite beeps and, quote, 13 days have passed on this planet, end quote. He almost dropped the shovel. 13 days? He shook his head, rubbed his forehead, rubbed the back of his neck again. He moved his mouth as though about to make a sound, popped and locked his jaw and sighed. Computer? Two beeps. Standby. Affirmative. Merlin made a larger circle over the spot where he spent the past 13 days. He found a body, barely shielded from the elements, about 3 meters from where he found the communicator. The body was not in good shape. He began by exploring the anatomy of the alien. Computer. And then, can you identify this species? Some kind of large biped, tailless rodent? And the computer talking. This creature doesn't appear in the bioform database, but I do not have access to a comprehensive list. The particular specimen had a badly deformed skull and was covered with, to put it bluntly, marks from a violent confrontation with an object like this shovel. As he was testing the texture of its skin, the creature began to move, and Merlin, startled, dropped the shovel and Merlin, startled, dropped the shovel and creature and jumped, or perhaps it's more accurate to say fell, backwards. Are you there? But nothing happened, and Merlin waved a hand in front of the creature's face, which looked considerably less deformed. Merlin squinted and touched its forehead. It was wet. And the creature sat up suddenly and took a loud breath. Merlin held on, even going so far as grabbing the back of the creature's head with his other hand and pressing. The creature got remarkably warm very quickly. Merlin considered letting go, but changed his mind as the creature's breathing became more regular. The dead creature fought Merlin and pushed itself away and untangled and shooed away Merlin's hands. Are you there? Asked Merlin. The creature didn't say anything, but instead started looking around on the ground. Merlin thought about his communicator and how earlier he did the same thing. He bent over and began looking for something out of place in the grass and brush. "What are we looking for?" he said conversationally. The creature looked up from its task with a snap of its head and said something rather loud. Merlin couldn't understand the word, but the creature immediately attacked him, hitting and grabbing and kicking and spitting as it said other loud things. Parrying, blocking, dodging repeated blows to his neck and between his legs, Merlin said, "I'd hate to have to put you back how I found you." And he said, "Please calm down." And he said, he's saying these various things repeatedly, "You will not win a fight with me." The fight, as he called it, took 20 minutes or longer. The thing had stamina. Merlin would have to either restrain the creature or wait for it to get bored. He hoped the computer was keeping a record of the utterances and speech patterns from the creature. This is Merlin talking. "I'm pretty sure you didn't hit me with the shovel," he said evenly. The creature stopped attacking, perhaps understanding the word shovel? He turned to it and walked to it and lifted it off the ground. It was covered in his own biomatter and with blood from Merlin. Okay, so that's the creature that he's encountered has picked up the shovel. Okay, the creature stopped attacking, perhaps understanding the word shovel. He turned to it and then... Oh, okay. Merlin rubbed the back of his neck as he watched the creature. "My name is Merlin," he said as calmly as possible, shifting his stance and placing his palms up in what he hoped would be appreciated as a gesture of peace. The creature, apparently becoming aware that its own brains were smeared upon the shovel, dropped it and touched the back of its own head gingerly where blood was still clotted in the previously matted fur there. It bent at the waist and began making muffled, sickly sounds, and then it vomited, fell to its knees, and vomited again. Merlin watched and didn't move, didn't say anything, didn't even consult the computer. His own hand paused, frozen, on the back of his neck. He slowly moved it back into the palm-up position from a moment ago. The other eventually returned to its feet and gave Merlin a confronting look of a comforting look of inquiry. It spoke and Merlin watched the oddly shaped mouth produce the words that he didn't understand at all. Merlin made a gesture of confusion and the other stopped moving. Merlin froze. After a minute that felt like an hour, the creature approached Merlin, who remained still. The creature began talking rapidly, but perhaps noticing that Merlin wasn't moving or understanding, started talking slowly and gesturing at the shovel. Merlin dropped his hands. He had never encountered an alien before. Hundreds of years in space, but never a meeting with anyone that didn't speak one of the standard languages of his home galaxy of Andromeda. But he began forming an idea. How does one, with their mouth full, for example, communicate? So he tried gesturing, but gave up shortly as there'd be no reason his gestures would make any more sense than his words. Merlin clapped his hands together and pointed at his own feet. He then smoothed the dirt in front of him. He touched his chest and squatted. He broke a piece of grass and placed it in the now flat spot of dirt. He took another blade of grass and said, "You," and blinked and looked up at the creature, putting out his hand palm down. Merlin placed a second piece of grass near the first. He stood and walked over to the shovel, which he lifted. Merlin wielded the shovel as the weapon he imagined it to have been. He froze. He waited, then slowly put the shovel back down. He touched the back of his head. His back and his neck leaning down into the side. He turned and stood erect, hoping the message was understood. He indicated the shovel and returned to the two blades of grass and the dirt. He touched his chest, lifted one, gestured toward the creature, and lifted the other. He stood and walked back to where he awoke earlier. He pointed and sat down and laid down and rolled over onto his side. He smelled his own blood upon the ground, but didn't see it. He waited several seconds, then, pantomiming his own awakening, the waking up, the rubbing his head, the standing and looking around for his communicator, he then reenacted discovering the other, walking in an arc from his starting point and leaning down to investigate the corpse. Gratifyingly, the creature began to give signs of understanding, enthusiastically nodding its head and making squeaky noises Merlin did not take to be threatening. "Merlin," he said, touching his torso. The creature's eyes opened and it touched its own chest. It grunted unintelligibly. It pointed at Merlin and grunted an approximation of the word Merlin. "Crap," thought Merlin. "This is hard." "Computer, two beeps," he says. "Do we have enough information to translate the language it is using?" "No," the computer said that. The sound in his mind almost unnaturally clear after the wind-driven articulations of the other creature. The machine, meanwhile, didn't elaborate. And that's the end of that section and the end of chapter 3 of Macmillan the Magician. Okay, well, that was the entire chapter 3 of Macmillan the Magician. So, what have we got? He's wandering around. He found a lizard, thinks it smells like his own people. He saw some phantom of a woodsman of something, some kind. He figured out how to talk to the computer in the escape pod. I didn't probably do it justice, but the escape pod computer sounds bitchy to him. We know that he landed on Earth, so he encountered a human, but he keeps referring to the human as an alien creature, of course. So he encounters a human. Oh, wait. Now, first, he goes unconscious because he's murdered with a shovel. Then he wakes up. Then he figures out that he doesn't have his little headphone thing. So he finds a little headphone thing. Then he circles around and he finds the human with the caved-in skull because he was also killed with a shovel. He revives the guy by touching him. It's less dramatic in this novel than in the other novel. I'll give you that. It's not really a spoiler. It happens pretty early on in the other novel as well. In fact, it doesn't take until chapter 3 in the other novel for us to learn that the main character can revive creatures. Anyway, let me see. And then he tries communicating all kinds of things, and he gets to a point where now it's not really obvious. But when he's saying Merlin, the other creature's repeating back Macmillan. And we're getting to a part where it's gotten complicated by my having to do additional research to complete the book, because as soon as the main character from the invented universe encounters humans in the world that the reader will know, so 1885, Southern California is a real place, the solar system's a real place. As soon as these things start happening and he starts interacting with people, well, then I'm kind of out of my depth and I have to go read some histories of, say, Pasadena or the north part of Pasadena and that whole part of the San Gabriel Valley. And I have to figure out how people talk to each other, what kinds of ranches and what kinds of towns he might run into. I've been, consuming some Westerns and stuff. So now you've got some additional insight into things. Alright, I hope you enjoyed the read of chapter 3 for Macmillan the Magician. And get any feedback, maybe I'll read the next part. But like I said, we're fast approaching the part where I don't have anything written down to read, because I'm out of my depth in terms of what it was like 150 years ago. Okay. Okay, so this is probably a ridiculously long episode, but if you were invested, that is, if you listened to last week's episode and you got interested in what's going on with our friend Merlin, aka Macmillan of the title, then maybe it'll be worth it for you to continue. That's all. I guess none of you other than Jennifer want to read me things, or read for us, and on that note, I want to say thank you to her. She also recorded me another intro I think she just doesn't like the goat noise, so we'll use her intro, but after she complains about the goat noise, maybe I'll take the goat noise out. All right, once more, thank you, Jennifer, for the WTF and the other WTF this week. And of course, thank you for recording me a new intro. Thank you guys for subscribing and for listening. And come on, you know, you really can just find me on social media, send me a DM or a tweet. You can find me, Common Cormorant on Instagram. Just respond to one of my posts about the podcast and I'll get to you. You can record your voice and we can play it on the podcast. Anything goes. I don't even care if you talk politics. If you want me to read something, I'll read it. But if it's political or, you know, controversial in any way, I don't want to read. You can read whatever you want. But don't make me read your opinions. How about that? But I can read fiction. I don't care if I read fiction. And if a character in your fiction has strong opinions, it's fine. I trust my audience understands the difference. And I trust the audience if I say, oh, this is something I'm reading for someone. But I really don't want to have audio of my voice reading things that, or saying things that I don't agree with that could be taken out of context like that. Anyway. So, yeah, I've been Robert. I've been R. Wesley Edwards, your cormorant of the Cormorant Cafe. This has been Open Mic. Don't forget to tip your barista. The mic is officially closed. Thank you from episode 10.
I am reality's whore!